The House Economic Development, Trade, and Tourism Committee to order, and the time is 12:24, and present, we have Representative Higgins, Representative Tarr, Representative Drummond, and myself, Representative Hughes, as usual. Other committee meetings are underway. We expect others to join us. And first up today, I'm excited that we have Don Dyer, the Economic Development Director from the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. And we had a conversation a while ago about the importance of whatever unit of government having an economic plan. And one of the things in this role that I've been learning is that Alaska doesn't really have an economic plan with teeth in it that has carried from administration to administration. And we are a young state. We are a frontier state still, and we have a long way to go. And we've heard the phrase, begin with the end in mind. It's important to have a vision for where we're going. And in some of the questions in various presentations, you may have heard me ask about plans, and I've been very surprised that they'll say they have a 5-year plan or a 10-year plan. And I believe we need to be looking out a lot farther. Maybe that's because of my age and having grandchildren. But a 50-year plan seems more appropriate, especially when we're a young state and there is much to be done. And so I've been impressed watching the work that's being done in my borough, because we do have an economic plan and things are happening. And so I asked Don if he might be willing to come and share some of that process with us, the importance of it, and how it has helped. And I also asked him to talk about some of the statewide projects that are underway that are part of their plan, and how it will impact all of us, in even as we look to perhaps, as a committee, working on a statewide economic plan with teeth in it at some point. And it's something that I look forward to doing, and we'll begin those conversations. So we hope to hear lessons from these gentlemen. We have also, we're honored to have Chris Gates, who is an economic development consultant, who worked during the Hickel administration, very actively involved with the development of the Port of Anchorage and the Port of Seward. And so I believe we have expertise that are at our table that can provide some real helpful things for us as we move forward and look at a statewide economic plan. And I'll just note that we're running a little behind. Do you gentlemen feel like about 35 minutes might be enough? Will that be enough, you think? Or because we want to go into the South Denali Visitor Center presentation a little bit after noon, and we have a number of presenters, which I will introduce at that time. So we'll get started, and tell us, Mr. Dyer, introduce yourself and tell us what we need to know about economic planning.
I'm Don Dyer. I'm the Economic Development Director for Matsu Borough, and thank you for inviting us to come and present to your committee here, Representative Hughes. And I was hired just about 1 year ago at the Matsu Borough, and I was excited to go to work as the Economic Development Director there, mainly because they had an economic development plan. And I actually have a copy of it here. I also have a copy on CD for anybody who doesn't want to have the paper around. I brought plenty of CDs with me of the Matsu Borough Economic Development Plan. And it was created in 2010, and it was a grassroots, very much a grassroots effort. It was created by about 180 people that went through focus groups, and these were all members of the community, business owners, people who were involved in government, and it really got down to what people wanted and needed in the community. And it's my privilege to serve as the Economic Development Director where we have a plan like this, and to be have the charge of executing that. So with that, I'm going to start off my presentation, and at first I'm going to kind of set up some of the dilemmas and challenges that we have as a state here. And first of all, you can see the pie chart, and we have 72% of the state's revenue coming from oil, and 18% of the state's revenue coming from federal spending in the state. And I know this is probably redundant to a lot of discussions that you've had, but this isn't a sustainable scenario for a lot of reasons. And since we're short on time, I won't elaborate on those, but I'd love to have that discussion. Again, 90% of our revenue comes from federal programs and oil, and what we want to talk about is the post-oil economy and how the Mat-Su Borough has planned and is executing a plan to prepare itself for a post-oil economy. This is a slide that I borrowed from Neil Fried's presentation. It shows the other it shows all 50 states and in job growth and job losses, and you can see that most of them have lost jobs through the 2007 to 2012. But you can see that we have Louisiana, Texas, Alaska, and then North Dakota, where we have job increases. And if the Mat-Su Borough was a state, that would be its job increase. And all those other the thing that all those jurisdictions have in common is that they do have resource development. Except for the Mat-Su, we don't have a lot of resource development going on there, but we do benefit from resource development in other parts of the state. And that's one reason I'm showing this slide, is that we have an integrated economy here, and it isn't just a Mat-Su economy that I'm going to talk about. It's the state economy. We have a strong history in Mat-Su of job growth. That's true for a lot of places in the state. We have employment. We've never had a down year of employment in the Mat-Su Borough in since going about 16 years back. We have this slide shows where most of our employment is in the sectors, and these line up with a lot with the state, where it shows government there with 40%. Most of that is our school district. And then this is how the average earnings in the Mat-Su Borough stack up against as far as which sectors make the most money. And what's interesting to look at is the Mat-Su average income is $37,000 per year, where the Anchorage average is $54,000 a year. Now the next slide is going to tell us a little more about that. The interesting thing is, this is where the residents for the Mat-Su Borough work. We have 31% of the Mat-Su Borough's residents, 16 to 20,000 people a day, commute to Anchorage for their employment. And this is a model that we'll talk about later in the presentation, and what we might be able to do as a state to create more jobs and bring in more labor that we badly need here in the state. As far as foreclosures go, this is what happened with foreclosures nationwide. This is the Palmer Recording District in Mat-Su Borough, but it's pretty much models what the entire state did. You can see 1987 was what happened when oil prices crashed. But because of the way that we buy mortgages and real estate here in the Mat-Su Borough, and also because we had a stable economy, we were barely touched by the foreclosure crisis that plagued the rest of the nation. The Mat-Su Borough, in 2012, we have had we're not only the fastest growing place in the state, but we also have the fastest business growth rate. And we've had 1,165 new business licenses issued in the year of 2012, and for the first 2 months of this year, that rate is still keeping pace. So we have a lot of economic interest going on in the Mat-Su Borough. So where does all this good news come from? And it comes from statewide. it comes from our the impact of oil tax revenues. We have, you know, we're dependent on that. And I just want to show some vulnerabilities that we have here. If we do, the state of Alaska's revenue is about $13.6 billion. Oil supplies 72% of that at $9.7 billion. And we have about a quarter of a million households in the in the state. That means there's about $38,700 of revenue per household, or $13,000 per person. So what happens if we were to cut oil revenue by 25%? What would happen? And we had to replace that with some other tax that was borne by our citizens. Well, we'd end up having to tax each household at a rate of about $9,600 per household. And what would that do to our PFDs? One of the strengths that that Alaska has economically is we actually, in a way, have 13 months a year of income because we have our PFD every year. But if we ended up having this tax, having to replace that with revenue from our residents, then we'd end up cutting ourselves probably back to 11 months of income per year. And that hurts our, that'll definitely harm our economy. So what's the Mat-Su Borough doing and to solve and guard against these problems and make it a livable place for our residents and a place where our residents can thrive and have abundance and have the quality of life that we enjoy here in Alaska? And we have the Mat-Su Borough Economic Development Plan, and the Economic Development Plan is broken into five goals and then 25 strategies, actually 26 strategies underneath all of those goals. And what we've done is we've formed work groups under each of these strategies. And I have the yellow strategies that you see are the ones that have the active work groups working right now. And the other ones should be active by the end of April. The work groups meet anywhere from twice a month to once a month, and some work groups are working very, very effectively. This is everything from tourism to aviation to business outreach to agriculture. You name it, there's a work group for it. Fisheries was just another work group that was formed. Our Mat-Su Borough Economic Development Plan is a living document. We amend that document. There are a lot of things that aren't relevant today that were relevant in 2010, and there were things that needed to be added to it. So our work groups have been empowered to make changes to the document according to what they find out there in the economy and what's needed. I've been amazed, frankly, at the response that we've gotten as we've formed these work groups and called for people to join them. There have been several of these work groups are now populated with professional people that know how to run meetings, know how to run the work group. They do it all themselves, and I'm pretty much hands off. They just give me their reports and I attend as I need be. Some work groups we're having to work on, you know, I have to facilitate more, but it has amazed me, and there's probably close to over 100 people that are working in these work groups overall, and it's been very gratifying to see the response that's gone on.
Allow me to interrupt for a moment.
Yes.
Don, could you just speak very briefly I know that you your history is more recent, but the development of the plan itself, about how long that process took, and then were the work groups part of that plan, or was that something that you decided would help implement? And then are there formal parameters as far as the work groups and their providing reports, or how formal of a process is it?
Right. The plan was formed in 2010. I think it took TIP Strategies about a year to work through that process. I wasn't here for that. And but there's in the front of the plan, there's the names of all the participants, and there's about 180 participants listed in there. As far as the work groups go, and how formally they work, these are not official committees or boards. A lot of them interact with official committees or boards, like the planning board or the aviation board, and so the work group actually is meant to add an economic development facet to those boards. And so, you know, a lot of times the board just is, aviation's a good example. The board will actually function to manage the workspace and set policies, or airspace and set policies, and all that. But the work group actually is working to form up what airports are doing what, and try and come up with an economic model for the Matsu Borough airspace. As far as reporting goes, they have agendas that they generate. They take meeting notes or minutes. Those are circulated after the meeting to all the members for approval. I get a copy of that too, of the approved minutes, and then that creates the next agenda, and we keep moving them forward as they work through the action items that are in the economic development plan.
Just as follow-up to that, then, as they're meeting now, and they've been meeting, you got them going off the ground since you came in, correct?
Yeah.
And then the idea is that they will go on indefinitely, or is there a goal in mind, and are you summarizing the feedback and the reports back to the assembly, and then making changes to the plan? As you said, it was a living document. Just let us know more about how the work groups fit into the whole process.
The work group process started back in November, and so we're fairly young in the process. I haven't been doing formal reports back to the assembly. I do let my boss, the borough manager, know what's going on in the work groups. Eventually, it will become more formalized, but the first step in all this was finding out how much interest there was, and then we'll move on to formalizing it. We will have a website up probably in the next month, where we will be able to show the work groups, post all their minutes and meeting notes, and also show their progress on the action items that are in their strategies.
It seems to me that growth is something that you all want to continue, so I'm guessing there's a chance that these might continue long term. Is that what you're envisioning?
Yes, some of those strategies are perpetual. You know, for instance, reaching out to veterans, that is a perpetual strategy. We know that we'll put a mechanism in place for that, or a group of people in place, and they just keep doing it and doing it and doing it. The same thing with business outreach. New businesses come in, and economics change, so we need to be reaching out to our businesses at all times. And so those are perpetual programs.
And members, feel free to jump in and ask questions. I'm always just seem to be full of questions. But I'd like to know the makeup of the work groups. I know it's a variety and it's open, I understand, to anyone. But are you seeing a lot of folks, private industry folks, primarily in the work groups as opposed to government officials?
We have both. Folks? Yes, definitely both. We have, especially where there's transportation issues and anything that might involve planning. That's where the cities of Wasilla and Palmer, they have their community development people there, and we definitely have people involved at all levels. So I'm just going to watch the time here. So, all right, so moving on, also the Matsu Borough has a a tax model. I did a study among all the jurisdictions in Alaska, and in the unincorporated area of the Mat-Su Borough, it ended up ranking as the friendliest tax model that there is. It is amazing how companies, especially mid to large size companies, are very tax sensitive, and these are your companies that really build jobs and build stability. And so legislation regarding the taxation of companies is very much something that would be something you'll want to look at in your economic development plan for the state level. Port McKenzie, and we don't have time for the presentation today with the way our time is scheduled, but Port McKenzie is an all-Alaska project. This is, we have our rail project to connect the port to the main rail line in Houston. And just to speak to a conversation Representative Higgins and I were having a few minutes ago, I went up to Fairbanks back in December to do a presentation for the Chamber of Commerce and for the Mining Association and then for three other corporations up there. And I went up there with the mindset that they would be interested in sending goods out of Port McKenzie from their mines and that this would be a boon to them that way. And within a few minutes of each meeting, it's like, no, that's, you have the wrong idea here. What we're really excited about is the ability of bringing in heavy equipment and all of the goods needed for mining and infrastructure development through Port McKenzie, because we have, you know, we do that all the time. That's what Port McKenzie is built for. The Fire Island Wind Project, we brought in goods for that. We bring in heavy equipment all the time. We're going to have weekly barge service starting next month, I think, either that or in May. We're from Seattle to Port McKenzie and to Kodiak. And so there will be, we have a company who's set up clients for doing that. So Port McKenzie is very active as far as bringing in scrap metal, lumber, and bringing things offshore. So it's it'll be a big boon to the interior of Alaska. And then, of course, all of the resources, once that infrastructure is built in the interior of Alaska, then all the resources that can flow out of Port McKenzie. That's why we have the conveyor there that fills coal ships and wood chip ships and gravel ships, and most of the, when the Port of Anchorage did their expansion, all of their gravel came from Port McKenzie and our gravel pits. And we loaded them right there and just pulled them a mile and a half across. I'm sorry.
Representative Drummond.
I'm sorry. As a member of the, former member of the Anchorage Municipal Assembly, a lot of the gravel came from J-Bear, right up the hill from the Anchorage from the Anchorage port.
Yep.
But I do have a question on, this is a conceptual drawing of the finished port, not the, does it look like this today?
That's pretty close. There's a little more finish work on it. That picture was taken shortly after the barge dock expansion was done. Mm-hmm. But that's pretty close to what it is today.
I'd like to do a tour in the summer. I've been intending to come out to Mat-Su for quite some time. I'd like to see the prison and the port and the Kubota offices and all of that.
I'd love to take you on a tour of that.
That'd be great.
Mm-hmm. That'd be great. And we had 2 weeks ago, we had a lunch meet and greet with the Port of Anchorage Port Commission, with our Port Commission, and we're very excited to work together. And
how did you get them there?
No, they all kind of suggested it. The two port directors did, and it was actually a very great and friendly meeting. And you know, there's a lot of problems we can solve for each other. Mm-hmm. And it's I know a good example was on the gravel issue. We supplied about 900 tons of gravel, and you know, we needed a hill removed. They needed gravel. Mm-hmm. They got a good price on it, and it worked out. And so we are we add strategic redundancy to the port system of Alaska, and this is definitely an important on ramp and off ramp for resources on the main rail line.
Don, without getting us too off time here,
sure.
Can you just speak in a nutshell how the ports complement one another rather than competes, so to speak?
You bet. That's an important question. And you know, the Port of Anchorage is the main access point for all of our consumer goods that come into Alaska. 240,000 containers a year come through the Port of Anchorage. And that is the main advantage to the Port of Anchorage. The Port McKenzie, we have two advantages. We don't have a dredging or depth issue there. We self-scour, so we can bring in larger ships that we can load there. We also have 14 square miles of land available. You can build anything you want out there. Bring in the pieces on the ships or barges, weld them all together, then throw them on the train and take them north. And whether it's pipelines or bridge construction or whatever, that was one of the main points that the people in Fairbanks made to me, is that we can bring bigger pieces north on the rail cars than you can from the other ports. Now, Seward is an important port. That's where Usabelli and the port and the railroad have a joint venture to send coal out, and that is where it's the northernmost free water port or ice-free port in Alaska. So it's very important for coal shipments going out and for Usabelli's business. We're an important redundancy to that. What we do with Port McKenzie is it was originally designed to be an export port for resources, and you know we bring in, but we also have that added ability now to bring in lots of heavy equipment. So we help with that depth in our port system.
Madam Chair.
Sam Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It may not be the right time in this discussion to talk about the regional authorities that are now missing in the Anchorage and Matsu area, but I'd like to talk about that at some point. I don't know if you touch on it towards the end of your presentation, but let's just put that on the side for now.
That would be okay. A good conversation, so we'll put that on hold. Go ahead.
Okay. So what are some of the strategies that the state of Alaska can use to prepare for a post-oil economy? And I'm going to pass this to Chris and to Chris Gates and let him talk a little about, well, I'm going to talk a little about the first part of this, and then I'm going to give him some other ones. I think an important thing that we need to think about here in Alaska is that we need to invert our business model or our paradigm in thinking about our economy. And what do I mean by that? There's this phrase that keeps coming up over and over again, economies of scale. And the thinking that we have in Alaska is we try and measure the consumer capacity of Alaska and then ask ourselves, do we want to build a business built on the consumer capacity of Alaska? And the fact is, Alaska only has 250,000 people, or 750,000 people. It's not a huge marketplace. So we have to kind of take the model and turn it upside down and recognize who our customer really is, and that we need to think globally, and that we need to use global exports as our economy of scale, and let Alaska take advantage of what's left over, or the excess capacity. And you can see this in several countries like Dubai, Singapore, all kinds of places like that. They have very effective and thriving economies based on that type of a model. I think I lost a slide there, but anyway, I'm going to let Chris talk about this and and he'll kind of give you the scale and some of the advantages that Alaska has.
I'm just going to go fast, and I'm going to...
Thank you, Don. Introduce yourself for the
sure.
record.
Sure. My name is Chris Cates, and I was the first director of marketing development for the Port of Anchorage. I was the first director of marketing development for the Port of Seward. I was head of economic development for the state of Alaska under Willie Hickel. I was head of the Alaska Forest Association in Ketchikan, and head of the ADAC Reuse Corporation out on ADAC.
Can you get a little closer to the mic? Pull it, maybe.
Sure. I'm an economic development professional, and my job is to make things happen. No matter what, make things happen. And I'm here to say that about 8 or 9 years from now, with the decline of oil, unless we start now, unless we start being very aggressive right now, we probably will have a huge demise in economic activity that all of our families will feel. And so one of the reasons I'm here as a friend of Don and as a past Alaska professional is to encourage you to be very aggressive in your economic development attitude and your aggressiveness with regard to making things happen 8 years from next Thursday. Because we're losing oil at an increase, we're decreasing at an increasing rate. And you all know everybody has a magic number. When the pipeline is not sustainable, by that time we either have to have oil in it or we have to have something that comes close to replicating an economy based on 70% oil. I want to plant 8 seeds here right now. I won't have any time to go into them at all, but I want to tell you that there are very creative people in the state, and you will probably never have heard some of these issues before. And I want to tell you, Scott Goldsmith is wrong. We can create economic activity in the state sufficient to have a gentle letdown, to keep a vast majority of our population, to make things happen 8 years from now post-oil. That's why I'm helping Don. The Matsu Borough right now is the most aggressive jurisdiction in creating a post-oil economy of any place in the state of Alaska, in my humble opinion. And so I'm with him 100% to develop Point McKenzie, to develop resources, minerals, timber. And I want to encourage you as the Economic Development Committee of the House to be very aggressive in the next 8 years to make things happen, because we as Alaskans count on you. And I want to tell you, there's a structural deficiency in the state of Alaska. There's a bias in the Constitution for developing our natural resources. But DNR, Fish and Game, and DEC have primacy. The protection of resources, the protection of land, the conservation of land, the protection of fish and game assets has primacy in public policy. Nowhere is there a team like this that is out to create jobs and economic activity, aggressively advocate, not be balanced, but advocate for jobs and economic activity. Here's some creative ways, you haven't even heard of these before, that are capable of very large chunks of economic activity between now and 5 years from now. For example, joint ventures. The east coast of Asia, according to the United Nations, is going to grow 350 million human beings in the next 5 years. The United States as a country has, 390 million people? A whole new country is going to be created in eastern Asia in the next 5 years. They all eat. They all need food. Alaska has hundreds of thousands of acres of state land, and forming joint ventures with countries, large joint ventures, 200,000 acres with China, with Japan, to develop 200,000 acres might feed their 300 million growing people, might go a little way to provide food security for their populations of desperate need. They don't know where their food's coming from. We have huge expanses of land for joint ventures in agriculture. I was involved when I was working for Governor Hickel on a pig project. The Danish government and joint ventures had 33% market share of all pork production in Japan. The United States as a country had 8%. So they wanted to come to Alaska and do 600 full-time jobs at the Matsu Borough back then, just doing pork for Japan. But these joint ventures are a huge opening that Scott Goldsmith has never looked at, that the normal traditional naysayers saying we are not going to survive after oil, they've never looked at the creativity that we have in front of us to be able to make and pull ourselves up by our bootstraps in time to handle a post-oil economy. So joint ventures. And I want to tell you that I believe that the majority of the people in this room believe that ANWR is not possible. And I think if this committee took on as an aggressive, as an offensive, playing offense, for the state of Alaska, that if you got a tremendous chunk of money and you said, this is not just calm, this is war, we are going to fill that pipeline in 8 years. We're going to break open Anwar if we have to. We're going to do what's necessary from state to the rest of the country. We've never really taken a strong initiative. Yes, lots of things have been done, but to me, we can break open Anwar if we look at it creatively and we do it right and hard. And I just want to encourage you to, it takes a warlike attitude to be able to sustain the community, sorry I'm going on, to sustain the state 8 years from next Thursday, when in fact the pipeline may not be sustainable. I want to just plant a few more. The Dow Shell Consortium that Jay Hammond put together in 1983, he went out to 10 consortiums to look at the development of petrochemical resources in the state of Alaska. Nobody likes petrochemical. Nobody likes the sound of it. But the thousands of jobs and the 3 million tons of southbound general cargo making everything we buy in Alaska a backhaul, reducing the cost of living for every single person in the state of Alaska because so much is going out, is a real reason to look hard at petrochemicals. Fire Island was their chosen site, actually, in a competition of 10 sites around the state. And if you look at that green notebook in all the libraries, the Dow Shell petrochemical study, they said at the time that petrochemicals from North Slope were viable, 3,000 full-time jobs in the state of Alaska when oil reached $38 a barrel. Well, we're a little bit beyond that now. We might want to dust that off. But as a model, how to bring these joint ventures, Jay Hammond did a wonderful job of bringing those consortiums and spending millions of dollars to look at that potential. So I'm going to just do a couple more here. I think the ARTA program is a very tiny program. I was involved with the start of it back in the 90s. And I want to tell you that having one human being playing offense in these huge regions of the state is a very small investment. Mm-hmm. And they answer the phone. When push comes to shove, they answer the phone. And the boards of directors of these ARTAs are, I want to say, even more important than the full-time person that your funds allow them to have. And the boards are aggressive, and they can make things happen. And I've seen some wonderful things come out of the ARTA program. Yes, there's problems, but I think your committee is right on track in looking at that. And lastly, the Watonna Susitna Dam. For the Matsu Borough, looking at having extra kilowatts, extra megawatts, having extra electricity for iron ore reduction, for aluminum, for bauxite reduction, for many other things that are totally electricity dependent, have the capacity, have the capability of bringing in hundreds of jobs. And I hope you maintain the option of a bigger dam. Right now we know that they're looking at the smaller portion. But don't lose the option of having that dam expandable so that industrial and economic activity can happen. Again, I come to you with the belief, a firm belief, that through creativity and a warlike attitude that we can handle a non-oil economy if we're there. But in fact, if we really push hard creatively on Anwar, we may face a lesser decline than I believe. With that, I'm going to hush up.
No, I appreciate Chris's comments and his passion and you know the vision that's there. And how much time do I have?
If you could wrap up in about 5 to 7 minutes.
5 to 7 minutes? Okay. Just to tell you about the marketplace that we have. Yeah, the question that always comes into business plan is, who's the market? We have a competitive advantage. We're 30% closer. You can see that on that slide. We're 30% closer than Los Angeles to Asia. We can be more competitive just on a shipping basis, whether it's by airplane or by ship. I don't know if you know this, but through the Aleutian Chain, 4,000 ships a year transit the Aleutian Chain. That's opportunities. They need things for those ships. 2,000 cargo aircraft go through Anchorage Airport every month. A lot of them are empty and are going back. They can haul back all kinds of our goods. Agriculture is probably one of our best opportunities right now. I don't know if you know about the ractopamine crisis in Asian countries and pretty much around the world. It's a growth hormone that's used by most U.S. growers. We do not use it here in Alaska. I don't even know if anybody has it here in Alaska, but I've checked with our feed producers, and nobody uses ractopamine here. But and we also have the lack of swine disease. Just to talk about ractopamine real quick, we have 160 nations that banned U.S. imports of beef, pork, and turkey on the 22nd of last month. Alaska is free of ractopamine. We have an opportunity here, and we can do, and it's a $600 million market for pork. Vegetables, the Asian market, especially Japan, is very conscious of quality. Alaska makes some of the best Asian vegetables that there is, and we can ship it out, and we have quick shipping on aircraft to Asia. I'm going to skip some of these, and I'll talk to you about the your economic development plan. If you're going to, we need to keep an Alaska-wide focus. We need to stop the regional borough and city focus, and we need to have an integrated focus. We need to think about Alaska as a country, and we need to take our position in the world like that. The lower 48 thinks that we are another country most of the time. We need to have that statewide development plan. It must be a grassroots plan, not from the top down, but from the bottom up. That's why the Mat-Su Borough Economic Development Plan is executing successfully, is because so many of the people that form the plan are actually active on the work groups now. And it actually is relevant to the rank and file citizens. I remind, one of the questions similar to yours, Representative Hughes, comes up all the time. What is the Mat-Su's Borough position on this or the position on that with the economic development plan? And I say right back to the work group members, I say this does not belong to the Mat-Su Borough. This belongs to the citizens. It belongs to the economy of the Mat-Su Borough. It belongs to the businesses. If you want it to succeed, you have to make it succeed. And you know, people come to me and ask me to help form committees and form focus groups, and I tell the work groups that, no, you are where the rubber meets the road. If you want those kinds of things, then recruit those people into it. That's why it's, I think, executing successfully, because people understand that. It's not a political tool. It's where the work gets done. And then one thing that I think is key is where performance is measured, performance improves. If you do a statewide plan, you need to have a formatting to the plan that's similar from the top down and from the bottom up, so that the reporting mechanisms can roll up and drill down effectively, and you can see who's working or what's working and who's not working and what's not working. It's important to have that structure, otherwise all kinds of things can slip through the cracks. And there's your market. There's Alaska's market. It's 4.2 billion people, and like Chris said, 300 million new people will be born into that market in the next 5 years. If we invert our thinking, economy scale, there you have it, and we can do this. You look at places like Dubai and all that; they've done it. And I'll just take us to the thank you, and I appreciate your time very much. Any other questions?
Briefly, Representative Carr. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Who prepared the, is this from you all in the back, the map here?
You know, that was, it's kind of a draft doodle that I did a while back a few weeks ago in Visio. And the thing that looks like a green orange tree, that's actually a technology system that creates what in a lot of places they call a food hub. Uh-huh. And it collects the demand signals from the marketplace and transmits those to the producers. And then, and conversely, it sends the inventory signals out to the marketplace, letting them know what's available. And if we can stop the latency in our supply chain because of nobody knows who's doing what. Representative Gaddis knows better than anybody else how much hay do I produce, how many horses are there. I just got done doing a study. I hired a consultant to do it, to actually quantify how much milk is sold in Alaska and which retailers sold how much and what the actual supply chain needed to be as the dairy industry was collapsing. But anyway, it's important to know that. And I think we can build a system here in Alaska where we can have a very succinct and cooperative statewide food production system. Mm-hmm. And I realize that doesn't have the whole state on it, but mm-hmm. the page just wasn't big enough for it. But, Kenai is important. Southeast is important. You know, there's all kinds of food components. Mm-hmm. And we can not only supply Alaska's needs, if we get we can supply all the food that Alaska would ever need and have all the food security we ever need if we supply the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And we do it that way. We have all the barley we need to grow all kinds of animals. Mm-hmm. So
thank you. And I'll just say, when I saw this map, I did talk about Western Alaska also, and I've mm-hmm. seen a map of yep. how the fertile ground in the world, and a huge amount of it is in areas we haven't really tapped.
Yeah,
do you have a quick follow-up? We really need to move on.
Yeah, and I'll
about
follow up with
them
separately. I just I would like to know about plans for value-added production facility, and I know that's been under discussion, so I'll follow up with them separately.
Yes. Sure, follow up with
Representative Drummond.
Thank you very much. This was fascinating. I do think we need to work on cooperating between Anchorage and Mat-Su. The Regional Transportation Authority, for example, seems to be languishing on a shelf somewhere. The Anchorage Assembly and the Mat-Su Borough Assembly have met periodically, but nothing ever seems to come of those meetings. And I think we need. I don't know how we kick their butts and get them started.
Are you meaning commuter transportation?
All kinds of things.
Yes.
All kinds of things.
That needs a lot of help.
Yeah,
I've had meetings on
New York
that.
City and. The state of New York and the state of New Jersey formed
right.
the Port Authority of
right.
New York and New
right.
Jersey. For states to work together and not have two boroughs working together is nuts. So
yep, you're right.
we really need to move forward on those things because I maintain Alaska's one big small town with really long roads, some of which are wet
yep.
and some of which are in the air. The airport was in my former assembly district. I know a lot about how that impacts our area and planes flying in or going out empty.
A lot of that transportation problem is in the federal funding and the way that money gets dribbled out to different jurisdictions, different MSAs. I need to mention the Denali, the South Denali Visitor Center Complex project. This is something that the Mat-Su Borough is very excited about and very much in support of. The development of this brings the infrastructure that develops that whole corridor from Talkeetna on north to Denali. And we'll bring lots of economic development to the Mat-Su Borough and to the state of Alaska on up to Fairbanks.
Okay, thank you, which is a good intro into our next segment. Thank you very much. And we hope that you will stay part of the conversation as we look into this possibility of a statewide economic plan process for Alaska. So thank you very much. I appreciate your presentation was excellent, and I wish we would have had more time because I think we could have learned more. Now we're going to move to the South Denali Visitor Center, and we have three people online, and I believe we have Myron, I'm not sure how to pronounce your last name, Nanning, also. So, Myron, would you like to go first, or would you like to hear? Yes. Okay. So, if you want to come up, we're talking about this project as far as its impact on the state of Alaska and why it's important.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the House Economic Committee. Is that right? My name is Myron P. Manning, Sr. I'm the president and chairman of Sea Lion Corporation. It's a village corporation that's located closer to Russia, where you can see it outside your door, from the village of Hooper Bay, right there. Our village corporation, Sea Lion Corporation, bought a native allotment, former native allotment that's located down the Parks Highway. And if you take a look at this map, it's this location here. We're working with the state of Alaska to donate 100 acres of that land for the South Denali Vista Park. And as you can see on the map, there's a road that's going through that. And it was the most, what they call, aesthetic way of trying to make the land more, more neater than a road that you can see when you drive up to the place. Sea Lion Corporation, working with the subsidiary of United Companies, has agreed to transfer some lands, at least up to $1 million worth, to that project. So far, we've received over $13 million from the state of Alaska for that project, and they've already started connecting the electricity and are starting to work on the road that's going to that South Denali Park. We look at this as an opportunity for our village, the village of Hooper Bay, in partnering with Matsu Valley as well as with the state of Alaska. And even though we're out there in western Alaska where people can't see us, we're pretty much a party to this economic development that's occurring right in smack in the middle of the state of Alaska, and we really appreciate the opportunity of being a part of it. One other comment that I would like to add that I heard the gentleman say about ardors. We're working on reestablishing the ardor, the Lower Yukon ardor, in Wade Hampton, because we see that ardor program as an opportunity for many of our villages that's right along the mouth of the Yukon, as well as down to Chivac and Hooper Bay, as an opportunity to bring in some more monies to the communities to develop projects within our village. And I heard that there was talk about reducing the funds for ardor. I hope they don't do that, because I think this is a good opportunity and for the villages to be able to look at projects that can have a positive impact to the community as well as to the state of Alaska itself. And with that, thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Myron. I appreciate your making the connection of how important it is even for Hooper Bay to be working with something so far away, and how we can partner. And so thank you. Appreciate your testimony and your comments. And also, I have got so excited about the economic development plan idea for Alaska that I failed to mention on the record that we've had Representative Heron, Representative Gaddis join us. And I don't know if you know about what time you came in, but it's been quite a while. Do you know, Representative Heron, what?
We got out at 11:45 in the other committee.
So we'll say about 30 minutes ago that they joined us. And now we're going to go on the off net here. We have Ben Ellis, who would you please introduce yourself? You're going to talk to us about South Denali Visitor Center.
Yes, Madam Chairman, thank you very much, and thank you, committee members. For the record, my name is Ben Ellis. I'm the director of Alaska State Parks. Look forward to talking to you very, very briefly about the progress on the Visitor Center. You should have about a 9-page printout of a PowerPoint that I'd like to walk through fairly quickly, because I know there's questions and there may be other folks on the line. If you go to the second page, the South Denali Visitor Center complex is located along the Denali State Park, adjacent to the Parks Highway. It's approximately 134, 135, somewhere in that facility. It is just, if you're familiar with where the South Denali pullout view area is, if you're heading north to Fairbanks, it'd be on your left-hand side. This location is around the corner, less than a mile away. The total build-out will include a visitor center, campgrounds, trails, and as Mr. Nene mentioned and some others, the electrification of the Parks Highway from approximately Talkeetna to this section. The total cost of this is $46 million, including the electrical, which is a $6 million of it. And total funds to date, $13.4 million from the state and a $1 million corporate donation from Princess. If you'll go to the next phase, next page, we're really excited that phase one of this project has been talked about for 40 years or longer. Mm-hmm. I think you also in your packet have the history of this project that started back in the 60s. We're really excited that phase one of this is finally going to break ground this summer. Spring of 2013, we plan on building a little over 2 miles of gravel access road on the lower part that will access a new 35 RV campsite that will have electricity to the campsites. There will also be a parking lot that will have 22 spaces for day use and parking at the trailhead. The beginning of ADA gravel trail and other trails as the project goes along, a maintenance shop, and then the preliminary design of the access road to the visitor center, and then, of course, as I mentioned, the electrical extension along the park's highway. The total cost of phase one that will start this summer will be $13.4 million. If you go to the next slide, this gives you a schematic of phase one. You'll see on the left-hand side at milepost 134.7, that's the South Denali view that I mentioned, the pullout. As you go around the corner, you'll see the entrance road at 35.4. The property that Sea Lion Corp has donated to the state or we're in the process of receiving, which we deeply appreciate working with Mr. Nanang's organization and with the subsidiary UCI and all those folks will provide about 104 million acres to the Denali State Park. They are retaining 54 or 56 acres that they're looking at the possibility of a lodge in that area. So you see that even this phase one has already started the economic development and growth that has been talked about that this project will bring. The road will provide access if and when the lodge is built. It will go up. It is a much better egress to the property. It's a better slope, a better grade to go into the campground, and that will be located in a lower part of the area on the mountain. And as I said, we expect to be putting that contract out in the next month with groundbreaking this summer and with good weather and maybe into the fall, we'll be very close to accomplishing at least 90% we feel of this campground and hopefully have it ready to open the spring or the summer of 2014. If you go to the next page, as we said, this also is going to bring three-phase electricity from basically mile 121 to 135 along the parks. Some of that area between basically Sunshine and Trapper Creek currently has three-phase. Single-phase. That will be upgraded to three-phase. And then mile 135 will be three-phase. All basically support a business, fire, emergency facilities as they become necessary along that area, and schools as well. So there'll be big improvements as far as the environment in the area, getting off of diesel generators, and going on to a secure three-phase power source. And the payoff along this area is just more tourism-related business opportunities that will come through that area that will benefit not only the area but the entire state. If you go to the next page, South Denali Phase 2, we do not have a starting date at the present time. It's funding-dependent, but it would be the build-out of the access road. The idea was we didn't one a large parking lot and a plain view up at the top that bars the view shed from the highway. So there will be the parking will be in the lower area. The visitor center will be in the upper area on the top of Curry Ridge. And that we'll also be able to finish off some walking, camping, and provide more not only ADA accessible trails but other trails for hiking up in that area. Hopefully at some point eventually working into a hut type of camping for a lot of folks that have been to Europe have experienced. That estimated cost of phase two is about $32.6 million. If you'll move to the next page, you'll see that that schematic shows the shuttle access road going up to the visitor center complex, another set of trails up around Lake 1787, and a build-out of the lower section for more of the activities will be down in that area.
Ben,
move to the next page.
Ben, can you
hear
me? This is, I just want to interrupt to ask, the phase one, will it open to the public once phase one, that part of the project, or will it not be open to the public till both phases are open?
No, ma'am, we're really excited. It will be open to the public as soon as it's completed and all the certifications have received. So, we're projecting the summer of 2014 for that campground.
For the phase one?
For the phase one, yes, ma'am.
And then what is the timeline for phase two?
The timeline of phase two is totally dependent upon funding. And the reason I say that is because, for example, I didn't give you the breakdown, but we first received funding in the FY09 budget, and that was $8.9 million of general funds. And basically, that was stored, and there was some preliminary work starting on it, but not a great deal. In FY12, 3 years later, the legislature provided $3 million to it, and then in FY13, 1.5. So as we received funding on this total project, of $40 million total, and then $6 million for the electrical extensions, for a total of $46 million, once we had received enough money that we could launch into phase one, we felt like we not only wanted to do it, but we, as for good fiduciary and stewardship of the funds, we needed to put that money in action. It'll also start bringing a small amount of revenue back to the state, but it'll also give people opportunity to be there and see the uniqueness of the setting that would, I think, help foster future funding. So the question of when does phase two happen basically lies with the governor's office and the legislature as to when funds are available.
And is there anything in the governor's budget for phase two right now?
There is nothing in the governor's budget for phase two. The philosophy was, at least from my understanding, was a focus on phase one of making sure that we put the money that we have received so far to good use. Obviously, I don't know what next year's governor's budget would look like. And, of course, our project competes with all other state projects, and that's a decision higher than my pay grade.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chairman?
Yes, ma'am.
Just a moment, Mr. Ellis. We have a question from Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman.
Yes.
Mr. Ellis, just wondering, you said there's been $1 million corporate contribution by Princess. Are they somehow involved in the development of this phase one in terms of having space in the, any of the facilities that will be developed? Or what did that corporate contribution do for them, I guess is what I'm asking. And then are there any other opportunities for that kind of investment?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, the $1 million corporate donation from Princess has an earmark for helping the electrical extension go in. So there'll be roughly $5 million worth of state funds and $1 million of Princess funds to fund the MEA electrical extension. They have a lodge that is just outside of the area that we're talking about. As you, let me go back. I think if you, I don't have it, but around 132 or 133 somewhere, yeah, well, as soon as you cross the river, you take a right and you go up to the Princess Hotel in that area. So obviously they will be able to tie into the electrical and get off diesel when this this electrical line goes in. As far as other opportunities, we don't know. I mean, we're always looking for collaboration. We're very happy that, you know, we're working with Princess. There may be others, as we talked about, the Sea Lion Corp and UCI is looking at a possible lodge in the area. We're working in partnership with the National Park Service and with the Mat-Su Borough. So we're always looking for collaborative opportunities.
Thank you.
Continue.
Okay. If we look on the slide, positive economic impacts, I'd like to first stress that this by no means is a list, an exhaustive list of the things that we had a economic assessment done by the University of Alaska in 2008, which is referenced toward the bottom. I would urge those that would like to hear more or read more about it to go to the State Parks page, and all you need to type in is South Denali, and there'll be a page that pops up where you can look at both the economic assessment and economic impact reports from the university. But it points that this is more than just an area-wide, that it's going to provide additional resident and non-resident visitor experiences from the, you know, especially Anchorage, south though from Fairbanks, even as far away as Homer coming up through on the way to Fairbanks. That the tourism expenditure is based upon the building of the visitor center. This is completion of phase two now, all these numbers I'm giving you. Is it expected to increase in the tourism area, you know, 17 million, even up to 44 million a year as this project matures? Job creation, again, looking overall, if we were going to build it all together, some 116 to 200 plus jobs in the construction space. We'll be seeing about probably 20 or 30% of that as we go into this phase one of building the road and the lower campground. And then in visitor services, you know, 200 to 500 plus jobs, and that would take into account the possibility of expansion, say at the Princess Lodge, the possibility of a lodge coming in on the UCI property, and other businesses that can spring up from the electrification along the along this park's corridor. And as the last point, you know, development of adjacent private land supporting tourism growth. So I want to thank you. I know this is a very quick overview. I had the opportunity last year to be there in person and do a much more detailed presentation for this committee. I realize there's many new faces, and I look to be able to sit down with you individually, if possible, at some point, and talk about this further. Are there any further questions?
Anyone have any questions for Mr. Ellis? Thank you very much. Your overview was good as far as getting the information out to us that we needed. And we have about 10 minutes, and we have two people online. We have David Kazer with Visit Anchorage and John Bittner with Anchorage Economic Development Council. And, gentlemen, I'm not sure if one of you prefers to go before the other. If not, David, you can go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'll be brief. My name is David Kasser. I'm the Vice President of Tourism, Development, and Sales for Visit Anchorage. And I just wanted to call and speak in support of the visitor center and the South Denali project. Really gives us the opportunity to bring the mountain to the people, so to speak. And particularly when you are trying to put together product and sell product in the United States and internationally, as you all know, people are fairly time deprived and they have to make hard choices when it comes to Alaska, because there are major things that they want to see and there isn't always time to do everything on the schedule. So they have to choose, do I do Denali or do I do Kenai Fjords? It's part of the reason that Homer doesn't get the visitation that it might get otherwise, or that Valdez might be not be visited to the same extent. And with this opportunity to bring Denali closer to the hub, it will allow folks to do something in a day that in the past has taken two travel days, you know, one day up doing some activity in the park and then, you know, one day back before they could continue to do something on the Kenai Peninsula. So this particular situation has stymied growth in itineraries that international tour operators would develop, or even domestic tour operators. And what has happened is we have kind of a Denali trench where, you know, folks come in, they run up to the park, they run back down, they get on the ship, and they leave South Central. And this would allow for more expansion and a better spend in, you know, tourism dollars to all of South Central Alaska. It would also relieve congestion in the existing Denali Park entrance, which would increase the visitor experience when they are there. And so I just wanted to speak to those points and a little bit about winter. As you know, as I just mentioned, getting up to the park and back with limited daylight hours in the wintertime, if we had this type of opportunity in the winter months when a lot of our meetings and convention folks are coming into town, they would have that opportunity to see the park, you know, either pre or post conference. And again, it would tie in well with other product that's available in Matsu, in Anchorage, down at Alyeska Resort in Girdwood. It would all be very achievable. So those are the main points. I think that a lot of the other particulars were covered very well just in the call before me. So I don't know if you have any questions.
I don't see any questions, David. Thank you very much for providing the perspective of how that impacts tourists coming up. And I was just thinking about the fact with our weather and the clouds around the mountain, I'm hoping the visitor center will have some very large murals of the mountain for those that happen to hit a day when they can't see it. So with that,
You bring up an excellent point that so many people that come up in the summer months to see the mountain run into that weather pattern, that's the great thing about the winter months is there's so much more clarity. And if we had that access, you know, from the south in the winter months, I think it would really, really benefit South Central Alaska.
Excellent point. Thank you. And now we'll move to John Bittner. And, John, if you could take just a few minutes. We need a couple minutes from some business here before we conclude this meeting. So go ahead and introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is John Bittner. I'm the Vice President of the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation, and there isn't a whole lot more I can add to the previous testimony. AEDC just wanted to get on record to say that we support the visitor center being proposed, and that our mission to grow and diversify the Anchorage economy fits in very well with what this will accomplish. As we noted in our 2013 economic forecast report, the tourism and service sector is going to be one of the major growth sectors for Anchorage, and that will be driven in a large part by the visitors that will be using the center, as well as local commerce that will come from it. So we're very supportive, and we just want to get on record saying that we think this is a positive move forward for not just Anchorage's economy, but the South Central economy as a whole.
Thank you, John. I appreciate your being so succinct. And we do have a question from Representative Tarr.
Just one quickly, Madam Chairwoman. Is the South Denali Visitor Center part of the effort, the live-work-play effort? Does it show up any in any of those documents from AEDC?
It doesn't. The documents centering around live-work-play are focused more on generalized metrics, but the Denali Visitor Center does fit in very well with the mission and the intent of live-work-play.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, well, thank you very much, gentlemen. It's been a good presentation. Thank you for updating us and letting us know about the statewide impact of this important project. So appreciate it. And before we adjourn here, I just want to reiterate what I said on the House floor about the next meeting. I'm pretty excited about it. We have Ro Bailey, who is actually a retired Air Force Brigadier General and now the Deputy Director of the Alaska Center for the Unmanned Aircraft Systems Integration up at UAF, coming to talk to us about this. And this will be an important presentation because the following Tuesday we'll be hearing legislation related to this, and this will be the preliminary presentation for that. Also, just to pique your curiosity too, she will be bringing a unmanned aircraft system with her that you'll be able to see that she'll be bringing into this building. So and they are anywhere from 4 ounces to 12 tons these days, so I'm guessing it's going to lean more towards the 4 ounce size, but I don't know exactly what she will have, but it'll be great to have a show and tell here. And then before we go, we need to be looking at summer schedules. We have the opportunity to learn more about our state, and we have been offered a trip to coordinate a trip that would go up to Talkeetna, up to Denali Princess, and then a tour of Usabelli, and then on up to Fairbanks, or ride on the riverboat Discovery. This is tourism related, as you can tell, and tourism and mining. Mm-hmm. And then coming back, and the dates proposed are June 4th through 6th. And I have to look at my calendar. I know some of us have graduations and things like that. So if you could please check your calendars, let us know how many of you would be interested, whether you'd like to bring a spouse or family members or your staffers. And I'll have Ginger will be getting in touch with your offices, and we'll see if that week works. And if that week doesn't, we'll look at alternatives. So. There are no other comments. I believe that we are finished here. So at 12:42, I will adjourn the meeting.